Well, thank you, Surf. I found out who signed this topic. I think it was Neil Kahn. And so, Neil, there's going to be payback for this. Because, you know, when you get these talks, they don't say, what do you want to talk about? They tell you what you're going to talk about. Well, it is Halloween. And so what we're going to talk about is healthcare systems employment, how do surgeons maximize their pay. Well, this talk is really about trick or treat for you surgeons. It's all about the money, and the money's going down, and there's no question about that. A number of people helped me with this talk, Vinay Badwar, especially from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons and the Chair of the Workforce on Practice Management, and a number of other individuals helped me give me some ideas so that I wouldn't look too bad. Well, the old way to maximize your pay is clear. Establish yourself in a community in a region. Have great relationships with a referring cardiologist, and if you're a thoracic surgeon, pulmonologist, have great to good clinical results. Work well with the hospital administration and the nursing staff. Work harder, you know, put more elbow grease in there and get more clinical cases referred to you, and have an efficient business organization to get the maximum reimbursement and the lowest practice cost, and to communicate with patients, the patient's primary care doctor, as well as the cardiologist. The iPhone, that's the best way to get patients in the past. Basically, communicate, communicate, communicate. But things have changed. The vanishing independent practitioner, this is from the advisory board company, and this is from 2009, which basically showed a cross between hospital employment and physician employment. And as you can see, at that point, it was approximately 50%. And this is where we're moving, especially with accountable care organizations, the possibility of these coming and driving this more toward unity. So the recent health leaders media survey done by one of the organizations asked the question, what are the top two motivators for physicians to seek and accept employment? Well, you can see it's stable compensation and income, the declining reimbursement, which is obvious, and escalating practice expenses. And from the administrator side, what aspects of managing physicians has been most difficult? I don't like the word managing physicians, but anyway, it's getting physicians engaged and working out the governance, as well as getting folks to have appropriate data management. What are the drivers for this changing practice landscape? Well, clearly, declining reimbursement for professional services, declining reimbursement for ancillary clinical services, especially in cardiologist's office where they have radionuclide scanning techniques, echo techniques, all these things that they were charging. Those have gone really into the toilet as far as reimbursement, driving cardiologists especially toward employment, increasing personnel costs, associated with those ancillary services, increased malpractice insurance costs, and the requirement for electronic medical records, which has cost us not only time, but lots and lots and lots of money. And also increased practice scrutiny. The regulatory demands are really onerous today. Other things include HIPAA compliance directives and more personnel to do this without reimbursement. These are unfunded mandates. Loss of fees to ICU physicians, such as the intensivists, hospitalists, and rehabilitation people, when you don't get your entire fee because the patient is not spending all the time on your service. Equipment replacement costs, bundled payments are a risk. If you're not getting the bundle, then you're not getting the payment. Single point payment is clearly a risk. And, of course, the impact of the Affordable Care Act is at great risk to us. And you can tell this every day as they beat up Sebelius on the television set. Don't get me started. We're moving toward the last breath of independence. And I think as doctors, we have to put this in terms of physiologic things. When the patient's PO2, economic pressure, and their PCO2, healthcare reform, cross, you know what happens. You go on the ventilator. So looking at declining practice economics, we see, of course, declining patient volume, ancillary reimbursement cuts, professional fee cuts, and increased practice costs, and that's the declining PAO2. The increasing PCO2 is healthcare reform uncertainty, incentive changes, the emphasis on value of care rather than just doing the case, the increased payment risks, and the decreased demand or us as a specialty, as a specialist commodity, as I call it, We've become commodities rather than professionals. This is what's happened to our workforce, and this is from a number of our group in 2009, published in Circulation. It just ain't what it used to be. Currently, and this was 2009, there were approximately 4,382 cardiothoracic surgeons in the U.S. That's about 1.4 CT surgeon per 1 million U.S. population. By 2025, there's reported to be and planned to be and going to happen to be 15,000 shortage in surgeons, or 25% less than the projected needed. And this is this paper in 2009. The declining cardiothoracic workforce is clearly for a number of things. The declining applicants to either the traditional programs, and currently now we have more applicants to the I-6 programs, but still we've lost a number of our applicants in the past. A 50% decrease in workforce because many of these individuals are over 55 years old that are practicing today, and the loss of experienced CT surgeons. This is very important. This is going to be a crisis because basically I spent 10 years training every other night on call for 8 years versus an I-6 program where you have an 80-hour work week. I figure you have about 40 to 50% less exposure to patients and patient care. There's got to be a difference. And when you look at this paper, the same paper, you see the demand goes up with the population over 65 increasing tremendously. And if we have 75 trainees per year that finish programs and enter the workforce, then you can see a significant decrement, and a less decrement if we have 150 CT trainees, which we're just not there yet. And the red line also shows the current workforce. So it will not meet. The supply-demand ratio is in the negative. Well, we have to think about our administrators, since this is where the money is. It's the old Willie Sutton. You got to go where the gold is. Hospital administration concerns include the following. They have increasing costs, too. Information technology upgrades have really cost the hospitals a huge amount, as have HIPAA compliance initiatives, supplies and equipment, new medical technology, personnel. The mid-level practitioner. Remember when you used to have residents on some of the university services where you had general surgery residents and then you had your CT residents? Well, now, if you're in a university practice, you may have a CT resident, but that resident will be associated with an 80-hour work week and all kinds of very detailed regulations by the RRC. So we have mid-level practitioners, PAs, nurses, nurse practitioners. And the increasing cost of these for the hospital has been tremendous. We used to pay for these people ourselves, either in our practices or in our university practice, but we've had to move all those to the hospital, but still the cost is going up and up. We have older, more complex patients, clearly with the same DRG, but increased cost. They get stuck on ventilators. We have declining reimbursement. It's not possible to increase per-case revenue with the hospital. There's no incremental revenue increase. And we have, in most hospitals, either a static case volume or a declining case volume. Now, in some large institutions, they still are increasing volume. But overall, I think most of us are at a static case volume, or we've declined over the last several years. Certainly, we've lost at least 150 cases over the last three years, even though we're doing about 1,000 cases. And their quality requirements are very important to the hospital because the cost, and this has been shown with Jeff Rich and the Virginia Quality Initiative, Alan Spear and others, that basically those costs, the higher quality programs have much less cost because of the complications. And clearly they're concerned, most administrators I hope are concerned, about the clinical workforce, as I'll show you, because basically the clinical workforce I think will get less relative to the number of patients to be treated. So if you look at hospital reimbursement, it's still pretty good. If you look, there's even a jump up here in 2008 in hospital reimbursement for certain procedures. And you can see here for a cardiac valve procedure between 2009 and 2011, there was an increase in reimbursement. So the hospitals still haven't lost money as of yet. So when they say there's no new money, there is money. But how do you get that money? Now, this is our payment going in the toilet, as you can see, if you extend that on out to the current years. So how should we be recognized? Should we be recognized by just bringing in value? We think we're valuable. We think we do these great operations. their patients do well in most circumstances, and we felt like we were valued. Are we just an RVU producer? How are we going to be paid? Well, we do know that quality outcomes can generate more revenue. Quality increase will decrease complications, optimize outcomes, and we can improve coding for the hospitals. We can do staff education. We can use the heart team approach so that we are much more efficient. But how do you keep Elvis there? Somebody asked me, they said, well, you know, we pay you too much. And I said, well, yeah, you probably do. I do a lot of surgery. I get a little bit from the university for my academic thing. I get a little bit from the hospital for my directorship. And so what about the rest of it? I said, just keep old Elvis around. And basically, we know that you are going to have to keep Elvis around because many of you are very experienced surgeons, excellent surgeons, and the residents that are coming along are going to be the same. We're going to have a declining workforce, less experienced young surgeons. Loss of program star surgeons is a problem. You know, you have the TAVR person who does an excellent job despite the cost of the hospital and to you getting nothing. But still, you have these, you know, people that you've seen today giving talks about complex aortic surgery. You know, those people can't be hired just in a minute. And if you rehire these people and you lose them because other hospitals can pay for them maybe, it costs much more. So these are the alignment models. And alignment is, I think, good and bad. We go from the private practice, and many of you are still in private practice, to university practices, and many of us are there, to having a private practice and getting a hospital supplement, obeying all the laws that you have to, Stark laws at fair market value. But what we're really talking about moving toward in the future in some form is co-management with the hospital, professional service agreements, or possible full hospital employment. Gain sharing, as you can see, has really been a hot potato. In the past, it's been a federal no-no. So when you look at gain sharing, which means sharing savings generated by the physician's actions and decisions with the providers, the OIG, the Office of the Inspector General, has in past rules ruled that these violate the federal law. But some of the recent OIG opinions allow gain sharing in special circumstances, which means shared savings with Medicare and physicians, but there's very little money that will come to physicians in this gain-sharing thing. So given the complexity and the intensity of the OIG scrutiny, we believe today that this is really not a realistic opportunity at present and not the best way to gain money. Here are the regs. The federal anti-kickback statute. The value may not be offered or given to influence referring, ordering, recommending, or arranging items for services that may be covered by federal or state health care plans. The Stark Law. Physicians may not refer Medicare and Medicaid patients to any entity if the physician has a financial relationship. The IRS regulations for a 501c3. Arrangements between a 501 and a private entity or individual must be reasonable and at fair market value. So this is the spectrum of economic alignment, from the least integrated on the left side of the screen to the most integrated on the right. And I think we're talking mostly about things that are shaded in green, because basically there's been a negative trend toward joint ventures, equipment leasing, a neutral trend toward just giving medical directorships or gain sharing. And I think we're talking mainly about PSAs, professional service organizations, co-management, and employment. But there are concerns about that from the hospital and physician adoption, legal constraints associated with it, and the perceived effectiveness of these techniques. Again, back to the practice management pearls from our workforce at the STS that Vinay has done. And basically this recent thing about test driving with your hospital, co-management. Co-management has emerged as a useful option for alignment while avoiding the necessity of full physician employment by a hospital. It provides a platform for physicians to work very closely with hospital administration within a service line framework while impacting both outcomes and costs without allowing the pendulum to swing too far in either direction. And most recently, in January of 2013, the OIG approved it as a mechanism for quality improvement and cost reduction with fair market values given to the doctors. And this is basically the co-management paradigm. You have a healthcare system, you have cardiologists and surgeons, albeit either university or private cardiologists and surgeons, and they form a physician LLC, a limited liability company. Now, there has to be investment. So the surgeons, cardiologists, could be your university practice, would invest, would capitalize this physician LLC. In return, the healthcare system would give you fair market management compensation. But they also will receive payment for management services. And in return, the physician LLC would distribute the management income to the physicians. This is legal. Generally, it's broken into fixed duties and to performance duties or variable duties. And this can be managed either in a 30 to 70% arrangement on either side. In most circumstances, fixed duties are usually in the 30 to 50% range, generally paid by either hourly or it can be done for the specific involvement. And this includes committee involvement, day-to-day management, strategic planning management, quality improvement, staff oversight, supply and material management, which is an excellent way to reduce costs and to increase income this way, budget development and process improvement. On the performance side, it comes down to clinical outcomes, patient safety, process metrics, efficiency metrics, satisfaction of the patient's metrics, and financial performance of the hospital as well as the service line. This is I think a beginning way to at least get in the same boat with the hospital. But surgeons and cardiologists and pulmonologists and thoracic and non-cardiac thoracic surgeons have to be in the leadership paradigm from the very, very beginning. And if they're not, then this just will not work. So the co-management of clinical service lines does have some positives. It recognizes the complexity of service line management. It shares or co-manages to achieve optimal outcomes and performance. And a contract between the hospital and the service line physician group or the LLC puts them at least in the same business paradigm. Select physicians will provide leadership for a fixed set of duties, as I've mentioned, and incentive targets are established and constant compensation is shared with either the group of physicians or an LLC, and that's only after the results are demonstrated. But physicians now have skin in the game and create a demonstrable hospital ROI simultaneously. It serves as a first step to a higher level of integration, and co-management is subject to fair market valuation. But it's key that the valuation of these different services that you'll provide, that is the key. How much money is it going to be valued by the hospital? Because if there's a low level of volume, then a low level of valuation, then you won't have any money to come back to you, even if you do good things. So this is becoming much more common. It withstands the scrutiny of the OIG. So we have opportunities for directorships in addition to fixed duties and variable duties. And, of course, the variable duties are the ones that we talked about a moment ago. Here again, this is pretty much, usually the fixed duties are 30 to 50%, even though the advisory board had said 70% for fixed duties. I think there's a more positive upside for physicians on the variable duties side. And if you look, 100% of the money will come to you if you have the right target, whereas only 50% of the money that's pledged might come to you if you don't get as good a party, as good an outcomes. So you have valuation from an outside company of the variables, and this is key. You have to be involved with the hospital administration when you have the valuation done. Low valuation means low money, even if you work your tail off. The other type of organization is a PSA, a professional service agreement. The specialty physician group enters into a contract, usually an exclusive contract with a hospital, to provide all required hospital-based specialty professional medical services. And all medical services and patients are now under the domain of the hospital. Your employees may even have to be under the domain of the hospital. This creates a problem in the university system. people who have now been into the university for years and years now would be possibly employed by the hospital, especially if it's a hospital that's not a university-based and owned practice. The billing is performed using the hospital provider number, and the payout is usually based on RVU generated. It's pretty much RVU-based. And the key is, how much are you getting paid for that RVU? Is it $50? Is it $65 per RVU? You need to negotiate as much as you can. How about hospital employment? Well, this is again from our practice management group at the STS. The physicians who will realize the immediate benefits of being employed by the hospital are those planning to work for 3 to 5 years. For surgeons planning working longer, short-term hospital employment contracts are problematic. The economy and the current financial crisis and the things you're seeing on television today are affecting everyone's retirement and everyone's stability and everyone's concerns. Some individuals who made the initial hospital employment plunge several years ago now are facing renegotiation periods. I always say the first contract is good, the second one's okay, and the third one sucks. Whether you choose employment or another arrangement, surgeons, don't sell yourself short and sign a bad deal because of the frenzy that seems to be occurring in our profession. You know, you still have some negotiating power. What are the key issues related to employment? Well, compensation. Is it going to be an RVU model and productivity-based alone? Is it going to be salary plus production based on your value, your Elvis value to the hospital? Is it going to be a guaranteed compensation for 3 years? But whatever it is, it has to meet fair market value. It can be under fair market value if they want to give it to you, but it just can't be over fair market value or we get into trouble. You want to know about the governance, the control over your practice, the ancillaries, the inpatient services. Can you help develop the CV strategy in your hospital? Can you even decide when you need to add new physicians? The benefits for physicians are compensation enhancement within the paradigm that I've discussed, stability, recruiting advantages, the increased influence over the CV service line. Healthcare reform is a concern, because when healthcare reform with ACOs and bundle payments come, at least you're in with the big dog. Hospital benefits, improving cost and quality to improve the ability to recruit and grow, to develop provider-based reimbursement opportunities, which are fading a bit, and with healthcare reform, it does benefit the hospital to have everyone in. So what's an ACO? It's an accountable care organization. It's groups of doctors and other healthcare providers voluntarily coming together to give coordinated, high-quality care to their Medicare patients. To ensure that patients get the right care at the right time and avoid the unnecessary service duplications and to prevent medical errors. And ACOs that deliver high-quality care and spend time with healthcare dollars more wisely and share the savings in the Medicare program. But it is run by the government. And I got this from Vinay Badwar. The question is how is your hypodermic going to feel? I think the trust issue is the big problem today. Now, you're negotiating with your administrator. And this is what the administrator looks like. He's looking at you and he says, and you say, I have lots of goodwill. I have many good things to do for the hospital. The administrators hate the discussion with surgeons about the value of goodwill. Measuring goodwill has no quantitative value and only qualitative impact. Administrators are afraid of overpaying surgeons because of this entity. So I wouldn't go in there and say I've been loyal. Loyalty kind of goes out the window today. What are the typical areas of negotiation if you are going to be hospital employed? The terms of agreement. Is there a signing bonus, relocation expenses, non-clinical income related to administrative responsibilities? What about your professional dues and getting to come to this meeting, your licensure, your continued education, your professional liability coverage, restrictive covenants? Can you not go anywhere within the next 50 miles or the next 1,000 miles? Vacation, your salary, bonus, incentive, and performance reimbursement, as we've talked about, administrative responsibility, and support personnel. But there are other ways to increase system value, such as through marketing and provider relationships. You should take the lead role in developing provider networks and solidifying relationships across your market. Physicians can educate regional physicians in services provided by select group of the hospital, and also medical directorships. The medical directors should be visiting physicians in hospitals. There are executive leadership roles that are potential. Faculty leadership within medical schools, and that probably doesn't pay you much. Administrative leadership within private practices. Emerging trend of health systems seeking experienced physicians as executive leaders, and clearly chief medical officer types of roles within the hospital. So these are my conclusions. It's an evolving reality. Surgeon salaries at risk of decreasing up to 50% within the 2012 MGA data. We're at risk. Service line unification of practitioners is essential. Even if you're still in private practice and you've got a university practice and you've got hospital doctors, you have to have a service line and manage that service line. And you have to have, if there are three different entities, manage it as one service line within the hospital. There are benefits for both surgeons and hospitals. Chasing RVUs, I think, is going to be a thing of the past regarding total pay. It's going to be your value to the hospital in many ways. Workforce projections suggest a 25% decrement in CT surgeons from retirement and decreased interest in our specialty. Residencies are shorter with work hour restrictions and less experienced graduates. They're all doing fellowships to get the experience or working with an established surgeon. The hospital will have to pay for combined work-related productivity as well as individual value achieved by culture and outcomes investment. And most hospital systems do not believe, and they really don't, that soon there will be a bid for experienced CT surgeons with reduced availability that we're seeing. I think this is going to be a problem for the hospitals, and I think those of you who are experienced and 45 years and young, then you're going to have you're going to be recruited very much so. Surgeons must realize that to increase their pay, they have to do more than surgery. That's a thing of the past. It's just not another case. I used to say getting the last case out of Rocky Mountain, North Carolina. Co-management and PSA models may be a safe, iterative approach to increasing your pay, and your value to the hospital is now multifactorial, not just doing that case. The development of an ACO will require consolidation and probable employment if these things happen. So when we start to negotiate, you can lose a negotiation and become the negotiated, like this poor little frog. Or, even if you're a small fish, if you do it well, you can win a negotiation. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
You have about 3 to 4 minutes for some discussion. Good, Dr.
Krasner.
First of all, sir, thank you very much for putting this on the agenda. And Randy, as always, it's a great talk. Again, as a hospital corporate leader, I want to comment to Randy's thoughts that really this is actually the opportunity, and I agree, frankly, with what the STS committee said. You don't want everyone to rush at once and think you have to be employed. On the other hand, you did give a very important message I think everyone has to hear, which is the MGMA cutoff has already occurred. So anybody who's negotiating in 2014 or 2015, your baseline is going to be lower, and you need to keep that in mind. I think that, just to reiterate two important points. Number one, for thoracic surgery as well as cardiac surgery, Randy's comment about not having to go full-time, fully employed, is very important. And most surgeons don't understand the opportunity in the PSA model, so I'm really glad that you brought that out, Randy. I think that's really important. And then secondly, I think this is true for cardiac and for thoracic, is the medical directorships. And I think, Randy, you're exactly right. It could be that you have one medical director for the overall program, let's say, in cardiac or the heart team. Then you could have sub-medical directorships for almost every part of the department because the hospital is benefiting from each of those. And as long as they're clearly articulated and there's fair market value, they're not stark violations, and those work out. So I think that's really where the future, and I think people need to think of that when they do the negotiation. I do think, like you said, Randy, you probably want to have a base salary when you negotiate, especially younger surgeons for those first few years. And then you want to have something that's linked to RVU. You don't want to link anything to collections in this day and age. And again, sir, thank you very much for putting it on today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Yes, sir. Yeah, Dr. Chitwood, that was a great talk. Frank Stoll from Hollywood, Florida. I just wanted to provide some information for those that may be going toward negotiation. arm yourselves with data. Don't just take MGMA or Sullivan Cotter salary data out there. If you go to GuideStar.org, all of the not-for-profit 501c corporations submit a Form 990 to the IRS. All of those forms are available for free. You just sign up, give me your email, and you can do your own research based on salary data across those not-for-profit institutions. Many of the places we work are not-for-profit, and most of the top 25 highest paid employees of those institutions, salaries are listed there. So you can go through, it takes time, but you can get your own data when you go to negotiate. You don't have to trust exactly what MGMA or Sullivan Cotter gives you. Just a bit of advice.
You want to be armed with as much information as you do when you go to negotiate. Billy.
Randy, great talk. You know, your comments about better outcomes creating better margins for the hospital is, I think, very appropriate. How have you used net contribution to margin as a negotiating tool?
Well, we're right in the throes of this. I will tell you this. And Mark Williams, who's my associate, is back there. We're the two of us are right in the throes. We have the university.
Yep.
We have the hospital. And so we've been given the task for the Heart Institute is to get this thing to work with these disparate groups. And in the past, you know, if I got positive contribution to the bottom line, you know, I might be able to, you know, we 29% of the hospital revenue, positive bottom line, comes out of the Heart Institute, 29%. And then they'll say, but there's no new money. And I say, well, I'll take some old money. Yeah, I mean, yeah. The point is they're taking this money and they're running the neonatal unit and all the other things.
Yep.
So it's really hard to negotiate for contribution margin. You know, when I say $500,000 in negotiating with valves, you know, I go basically to a valve company and I say, you know, let's sit down and talk about this thing. And they say, well, you know, it's $7,000 for this valve. And I said, I guess the meeting's over. I said, you know, here's my price. And I usually put it on a piece of paper, a little post-it note. And I said, here's the Chitwood price. And they said, well, we can't do that. I said, well, I'm sorry. I have to walk away. And, you know, I mean, I may still want their valve, but I'm walking away. But I always get about half, you know, get that. But that $500,000, I don't get it back to pay the surgeons.
Yeah.
And that's our problem in the university system, which has an erosive, can take a dollar and erode it down to, a, you know, a penny, where basically you don't have the dollars to pay the surgeons. And so the only thing I can get is, I need another PA in the operating room. So at this point, we're not getting what's coming off contribution to the bottom line of the hospital. We know there's a contribution, and we're trying to make them realize how important that contribution is. But you can't just say, you know, it's from goodwill. So we're right in the throes of this.
Last comments.
You know, Randy, one of the important things to understand about the way the numbers that you are given by the hospital that translate into contribution margin or bottom line are their numbers. And you got to ask a lot of questions about how do they get to their numbers. And the biggest fudge factor is indirect costs and how they attribute indirect costs. I mean, I think the point here is that you need to be very careful with the numbers you're given about costs, because you don't really have a good handle on what those numbers really are. At the end of the day, they're going to tell you, you know, you make a little money, which is exactly what you said, but not nearly what I think you've made if you really know what the numbers are.
That's
good talk.
True. That's true. But, you know, we have found, though, recently, we're a little bit more transparent with the hospital. I mean, they're a little bit more transparent with us. Before, it was total opacity. But now it's a little more, but your indirect costs are the ones, so when you take the indirect costs, probably your contribution margin is not quite as much. But still, we're making a bunch of money for the hospital. And you got to get some of that gravy.
I will tell you from personal experience that figuring out how they calculate indirect costs is very important. It is not as simple as you think. And ask them and try to figure out exactly how they do it.
It's an indirect science, and they can't reproduce it, and it's not accurate at all.
That's right.
They're,
There are no rules about how this is done.
They look at your square footage of clinic space and your square footage of ORUs, and they divide that by the amount of time you're there, and they amortize the tile on the floor. It's baloney.
Well, that would be a rational way to do it.
Well,
one of the ways
they say they do it.
Yeah, one of the ways that I've seen it done is the DRG payment translates into the fraction of indirects that you pay per patient. I mean, it's just all over the board. Find that out.
The number one increase in the indirect cost has been the increased hiring of administrators at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. I have data that'll show it to you.
Well, they're letting them off at a lot of places now.
It's coming.
Yeah.
Before you ask your last question, let me ask him a question. RVUs of 60 to 55, are you getting $60 for an RVU?
Well, I ain't getting 60.
You said 60 to 55. I wrote it down. That's what you said.
No. But I know some people are getting as much as 65. You know, our cardiologists are getting about 50.
50. Anybody here getting $55 an RVU? Who's getting about 40? Yeah, a lot more hands, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, I always say this is, the hospital gives us mushroom therapy. You know what a mushroom is?
No.
You know, it keeps us in the dark and feeds us BS. Go ahead.
Great talk. But if you're going to go negotiate with a hospital in a community that you've been working in for a period of time, that contract should not have a restrictive covenant at all. If you're going to negotiate with these guys, they've got a team of lawyers. I suggest very strongly that you hire your own warrior to help you in this negotiation. Otherwise, it's like a lamb being led to slaughter.
Well, I agree. You know what Shakespeare said about the lawyers, though, didn't he? Anyway, yeah, I agree. You are you? You don't sue doctors, do you?
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have a break. Visit your exhibits. Stay open. Thank you.